Hi, this is Patrick Bromley from fthismovie.net, and this is my solo commentary track for Tales of Halloween. This is just a fan commentary here. I'm not affiliated with the film. I'm just a fan of the film. Right now you're looking at this very cool opening credits sequence, the created by Axel Carolyn credit, and you're hearing the voice of Adrian Barbeau as a radio DJ, and it was at this moment that I knew that I was in very good hands with this film, because that is, of course, a reference to The Fog, and so you knew that these were filmmakers who clearly loved horror films and who were going to try to incorporate that into the film. You just saw a credit that this main theme right here is by Lalo Schifrin, who created a great theme. He's, of course, the father of filmmaker Ryan Schifrin, who contributed a segment to the movie. So a couple times a year, once or twice, I record these solo commentaries for movies that I just like. I keep trying to get better at doing these, and this one came about a couple of different ways. I had put out on Twitter, like, hey, I'm thinking about doing a commentary track. What should it be for? And I got a bunch of really good responses. Tales of Halloween was not one of them, but I had kind of decided on this for a couple of reasons. One, we're just a few weeks away from the release of the film on Blu-ray. It's coming out as a very special four-disc collector's edition, tons of extra features, a soundtrack CD, so I'm super excited to own that. And so I kind of wanted to get this commentary track out in anticipation of that, because I'm sure that's going to have commentaries from the filmmakers, which will be much more comprehensive and point out a bunch of things that I can't even cover in this, because you'd almost have to have multiple commentaries just to point out all the Easter eggs in the film. But also, the day that I'm recording this, I'm a few days away from attending the Bruce Campbell Horror Festival here in Chicago, and this is the third year that it has been running. Last year, the opening night film was Tales of Halloween, and I just went crazy for it. It was one of my favorite horror movies of last year. It's one of my favorite anthologies, I would say, ever. It is a film that I have gotten in a number of discussions slash arguments with some of my horror-loving friends who aren't as big of fans of the film as I am. And there's a bunch of reasons why I'm such a fan of the movie, and I'll probably be talking about those through the course of this commentary. I want to talk about a movie that I love. So there's the opening credit there, Tales of Halloween. I'm a fan of horror movies. I'm a fan of horror anthologies. I think this is a very good one. And the first segment in the movie here, which is just underway now, is Dave Parker's Sweet Tooth. I try not to play favorites with this movie because, truth be told, I like all of the segments. I mean, there's certainly some that I like more than others, but I do not think there's a dud in the bunch. And again, I know everyone would disagree, but that's one of the great things about anthologies, right? Is that one person's Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill is another person's The Crate, right? You talk about Creepshow and everybody has a different favorite. You talk about Tales of Halloween, everyone has a different favorite. And a nice little Night of the Living Dead playing on TV. So I try not to really play favorites, but to be totally frank, Sweet Tooth is my favorite. And it took me a little while to come around on that decision, because I was trying not to pick a favorite, but this one is my favorite. I think it's so good, and I think it starts the movie in such a strong way. It ties it into Halloween so beautifully. It sets up the tone of the movie perfectly, which is, it's funny, but not like overtly comic. There are other segments that are much more overtly comic than this one. It really embraces the horror stuff. It kind of creates its own ghost story or Halloween legend with this notion of Sweet Tooth. Again, I knew I was in such good hands when the parents who come to the door are played by Caroline Williams from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, one of my favorite horror films ever made, and still an unbelievable fox. And Robert Ressler from Vamp and Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. I, through a weird series of circumstances, and I swear to God I'm not just trying to name drop here, I was at a Flashback Weekend a couple years ago with my friend Heather Wixon, who's one of the hosts of Flashback Weekend, and we ended up in the courtyard of the hotel. The three of them were all having a cigarette. I don't smoke, but it was like, if Caroline Williams and Robert Ressler are out in the courtyard smoking, fuck yeah, you go join them. So I was with them, and it was just they just both happened to be guests of the convention that year. And so then a year or two later, to see them acting opposite one another as a married couple was just a weird coincidence, but a cool one. And this movie, for as stupid as it sounds, it's filled with little things like that, that somehow speak to an experience that I've had or my own life. I'm not suggesting that this movie's about me. Obviously it is not, but I think that's one of the reasons why I responded so strongly to it. I mean, I love this moment of them eating the candy and just cackling. It's just so funny. It's so funny. This truly, so this was the opening night. I just have to watch Caroline Williams for a second and be jealous of Robert Ressler. Dave Parker told me that this was her first on-screen, like, love scene, her first kiss on screen, which is astounding to me. And he pointed out, apparently, like, yeah, but you made out with Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw 2. And she said, oh, that doesn't count. So this is really her first on-screen kind of love scene, and she wanted it to be with someone hot. So she suggested Robert Ressler. I know it sounds like I'm name-dropping like crazy. So this is the opening night film, and again, I went crazy for it. It was one of the best times I've had in a theater in a long time, maybe ever. And there's, again, a bunch of reasons for that. So a couple of the filmmakers were in attendance. Mike Mendez was there, who directed one of the shorts and is a producer on the film. Axel Carolyn was there, who directed one of the segments and is a producer and kind of the mastermind of the whole thing. She was kind of the one who pulled it all together and said, hey, let's make this anthology built around Halloween. Paul Sollett was there, who directed one of the segments, and John Skip was in attendance, as was Barry Bostwick and Patrick Ewald, the producer. So there were a bunch of people there that were affiliated with the film. And it took me, like, after the movie, I wanted to run up and talk to them, but I was too nervous. And then I think I was standing in the lobby or, like, down on the floor prior to a screening of another film, like, during the festival. And Mike Mendez and Axel and Paul Sollett were attending other screenings throughout the festival. Like, they hung out the whole weekend and came back to see other movies. So when I saw them again, I was like, this is my chance. So I ran over to them, which is so very unlike me, and said, I just loved the movie so much, and I happened to write for Daily Dead, and I had this idea where I wanted to interview every single filmmaker who did a segment in the movie, and then leading up to, you know, the 10 days prior to the film's release, run an interview, and it was going to be called, like, Tales of Halloween. And they were super open to it. They're like, yeah, sure. And gave me some contact information and then put me in touch with some of the other filmmakers. And so that was great. They were very accessible and open to it. So I did have a chance to speak to all but one of the filmmakers affiliated with this, which is why when I say, like, Dave Parker told me, it's because it was in an interview setting, not because I'm necessarily friends with Dave Parker. Not that I would love to be friends with Dave Parker. Don't get me wrong. More Night of the Living Dead here. Where was I going with that? So I got all their information. I did the interviews, talked to everyone. I don't know. So some of the information that I drop about the film will be from those interviews. And it turned out, by the way, that, like, many horror sites had the same idea as me, because I was all excited that, like, oh, I talked to almost every single one of the filmmakers. And turns out that they talked to most sites, because why wouldn't they, right? They were promoting. I'm sure other people had the same idea. And a lot of the other sites, you know, are operated by, written by, whatever you want to call it, people who live out in Los Angeles and are friends with all of these filmmakers. So they have much easier access. They're not just this dork in the suburbs of Chicago, like fanboying out and being like, oh my gosh, please talk to me about your movie that I love. And here's, you know, certainly one of the reasons I think that I respond to the film. Again, I don't know any of the filmmakers personally, but I have been following the independent horror scene for several years and was familiar with all of these filmmakers and their previous work before I went into this movie. I was familiar with many of the actors who appear on screen, either because they are kind of iconic performers from past horror films and lots of them appear in cameos, which again, if you're a horror lover, this movie is exploding with shit to love. And I know that's one of the reasons why I responded so much to it, because it's just 100 minutes of here's everything you love, you know, in horror. But also there's a bunch of actors who have done some independent films in the past few years that I was familiar with. And so I don't have access to it, you know, but I've always just kind of followed the LA scene from Chicago, and it's hard to do at such a distance. But this movie was, you know, to me, the equivalent of hanging out with all of these filmmakers for 100 minutes and getting to see the kind of thing that they would do if given almost total freedom. That's not to say that they could do anything they wanted, because there were budgetary restrictions, there were time restrictions. And because I want to pause here for just a second, I thought I was all proud of myself when I spotted this. But did I miss it already? No, I don't think so. There's Sweet Tooth, which is just a great design and a great effect right here. Him reaching down the throat and pulling shit out. Again, this is one of the gorier installments, but that's also part of what I love about it. Did I talk through the Exorcist 3 shot? I'm so very upset that I did that. Maybe it's still coming up. Are we going to cut outside the window here? Come on. Come on. Yeah. Okay. So I was so excited when I saw this for the first time, because I was like, oh, that's totally the shot from The Exorcist 3. And I was positive, like, I spotted that. And Dave Parker is going to be so impressed that I knew that that was The Exorcist 3 shot. And he was so like, yeah, of course it's The Exorcist 3 shot. so I don't think he was really trying to hide the fact, or, you know, it's just one of the many homages that are found in this film. And yeah, I drop French words like a motherfucker. What was I talking about? Following the LA scene and getting to hang out. Oh, so budgetary. So one of the ways that, see how I got myself back? One of the ways that, and I love this too, that first of all, it's a Carpenter bar. How do you not love that? He even gets the font exactly right, of course, because these are people who know their shit. I love that this movie says there are rules for Halloween and you can't break the rules of Halloween. You know, that's such a nice touch also. I want to say the parents, right? It's Greg Grunberg, who has appeared in a couple things from Mike Mendez, and Claire Kramer, who's also appeared in several things. They're both in Big Ass Spider together. And Claire Kramer, of course, I think is the owner or just a big shot at Geek Nation, which hosts a bunch of podcasts, including Killer POV, which is still my favorite horror podcast. It's now become Shockwaves. But at the time, it was Killer POV, and it was running through Geek Nation. I love the punchline to this, too, because, of course, it can be read multiple ways. It's just a fucking home run, Sweet Tooth. And it's perfectly paced. You know, none of these shorts overstay their welcome, and there's so many of them. You get a lot of anthologies. You get maybe 4 or 5 segments. This one packs in so many that none of them have the chance to overstay their welcome, which is great. So now we're into The Night Billy Raised Hell, which is directed by Darren Lynn Bousman, and is the only short, I believe, I could be wrong about this, I'm pretty sure, to not also be written by the filmmaker. This one's actually written by Clint Sears, who is like a childhood friend of Darren Lynn Bousman's. So they've collaborated together before, and he wrote The Night Billy Raised Hell. So one of the ways that this anthology differs is it was shot. It was not shot piecemeal. It wasn't like, okay, you go off and do your segment, and you go off and do your segment, you go off and do your segment. It was one continuous shoot. So they used the same crew and kind of rotated people in and out. So every filmmaker got, I think, something like 3 days. Some people maybe got a little bit longer, depending on, you know, if their short was particularly complicated or whatever. So that's another one of the reasons why people weren't necessarily able to do anything they wanted to do, not just because of the time and budget restrictions, but also because this was really written in the spirit of kind of unity and family. And that's, again, one of the things that I love so much about the film and that I think really comes through is this idea that there is this very vibrant horror community, specifically one in Los Angeles. These people are all friends. They all socialize together. And they made a movie together. And in the writing stages, they kind of went through and made sure that no two segments were too much alike. Here's the first appearance of Barry Bostwick as the devil, who I think is very, very funny in this movie. And not underplaying at all, which I appreciate. I think that spirit of family, of celebrating horror, of celebrating this specific horror scene, all that stuff comes through for me. So in making sure that no two segments were too much alike, some filmmakers were kind of required to go back to the drawing board. I mean, I remember, again, Dave Parker, who did Sweet Tooth, the segment we just saw, talking about he had some ideas, but, you know, other people kind of got there first. It was like, ah, you already are covering this aspect of Halloween or whatever. So that's kind of how he came to, let's do a thing about a candy monster. Is it a monster that's made out of candy? And then, no, that's how he landed on it's a monster that eats candy. And that's how he came to Sweet Tooth. So everybody's segment had to be just different enough, which, again, I think they are, not just in concept, but in tone. You know, this one is all about just anarchy. It's all about fucking shit up on Halloween night, you know, and that is an aspect of Halloween. It's not an aspect of Halloween in which I have ever partaken. Just walking by right now, there's Felissa Rose and a couple kids who are going to show up later in the film. Again, you need to watch this movie five times because the kids that just walked by show up in Adam Girosh's segment. One of them is Tiffany Shepis's daughter. But Felissa Rose from Sleepaway Camp, of course, just had her cameo, and she'll pop up a few more times throughout the film. And that's the thing. Some people I don't even necessarily recognize because they're friends and family of the filmmakers. But there are a bunch of faces that I recognize. Oh, and I had talked about Killer POV, which was being hosted through Geek Nation. Killer POV was in many ways my entry point to some of these filmmakers, to kind of that LA horror scene that I've talked about being such a fan of, because the hosts of that show are all friends with these filmmakers, had them on the show, talked about them, talked about their work. All three hosts appear in the film, actually. We're coming up on one very shortly, I think. I love the punch in the balls because it's so basic, and yet, and I love the lighting in this one too. I like the way Bousman lights this. It's very, that's a great response. It's very comedic for Bousman, and it's not something that he's necessarily known for, particularly because he got his start with the Saw movies, and they're so dark and so bleak. His remake of Mother's Day, which is really terrific if you haven't seen it, is a very dark, bleak film. It wasn't really until he got into kind of The Devil's Carnival and Repo that the movies aren't necessarily funny the way that I think this short is funny. And believe me, when we saw this opening night, this thing fucking played. The audience was howling at how far this goes. And it actually pulls back in a way that I wish it didn't. And maybe we'll come back to that. Devil's Carnival and Repo certainly get into, I mean, they're tripping children. How great is that? Get into, there's Mike Mendez and Axel, who just came running out to steal the candy. There's Rob Galuzzo over there from Killer POV and now Shockwaves. These big crowds, when he pulls the gun, I mean, the audience just went nuts. These big crowd scenes is where you see a lot of familiar faces, and a lot of the cameos kind of happen. There's several that happen later. Here's maybe the best cameo in the movie. Not for me. The way it's set, my favorite cameo is probably Joe Dante at the very end. But the way that this is set up is very funny. And the punchline about the Twitter followers, I just thought was so fucking funny. Darren Bousman said that he wanted someone famous here. He wanted it to be a cameo, you know, from a celebrity, and wanted it to be, you know, a beautiful woman, and someone he knew was friendly with Adrienne Curry. And of course, if you know anything about Adrienne Curry, America's Next Top Model winner, Adrienne Curry, former Mrs. Peter Brady, Adrienne Curry. If you know anything about her, she is a huge nerd. She's constantly posting pictures of her in various cosplay, and like, she goes to Comic-Con and goes all out with her costume designs. So she's into all this stuff, you know, so she's a very good sport and was a very good sport about appearing in the film. I keep losing what I'm talking about because something new will show up and then I lose the thread of where I was. I think I was just talking about, you know, the kind of excess that's on display, the bigness of Devil's Carnival and Repo. That is a gorgeous shot right there. The theatricality, kind of the oversized, the broadness, whatever you want to call it, of those films is really what's on display here. So here the movie pulls its punches a little bit. Like, as it was going, I truly was hoping that he had talked this kid into doing all of this stuff and corrupted this kid to such a degree that that it was really the kid pulling the gun and tripping the children and stuff. And so it pulls back a little bit and says, actually, it was this little demon sidekick who, now he's kind of framed the kid, and it sounds very much like the kid is shot by the cops at the end of this segment, which is a little weird and maybe darker than, and the cops of course are played by director Adam Green and Graham Skipper from Almost Human and The Mind's Eye. And he played Herbert West in the Reanimator musical that ran for a long time. So there's those gunshots over the black, which leads you to believe. I'm unable to decide if it's just a punchline, like a way of punctuating that scene, or if it's literally, are we supposed to think that the cops shot that kid, which I would feel super weird about. There's Trent Haga from Troma and writer of Cheap Thrills. He got his start with Troma. There's Tiffany Shepis, who also got her start with Troma. And so we are now into Adam Girosh's segment, which is called Trick. This one, I think, is also written by somebody else. I'm sorry. I thought that this was written by Adam and his wife, but I think this is written by a guy named Greg Commons. So I apologize for misspeaking earlier. Adam Girosh, I tried to coordinate with, came very close to speaking with multiple times, and was never able to. And so he was the one filmmaker that I never did get a chance to talk to, which is a bummer. But that's okay. And this was honestly the segment that I felt, I don't know how to explain it, the weirdest about when I saw it the first time, because it felt out of step. Okay, so here's a quick story. There's Marnie and Rebecca McKendry. As we pan up, we will see Rebecca McKendry, formerly of Fangoria, now of Blumhouse.com, one of the hosts of Killer POV, and now Shockwaves. And I say that because the first time I saw this movie, Marnie came on screen and I was like, hey, I recognize Marnie. And then I felt weird about recognizing a child. Here's Tiffany Shepis' daughter. I felt super weird about recognizing a child And then, you know, Becca was in the scene with her, and it honestly is because I'm, you know, friends on Facebook with Becca McKendry and have seen so many pictures of Marnie show up in my feed that I knew right away who it was. But that was almost like a celebrity sighting for me. I was like, ooh, look, there's Marnie McKendry. Which means I might be in too deep to, I'm not a stalker, but I might be in a little too deep with the whole LA horror scene. I don't know. Trent Haga just got fucked up and stabbed a bunch of times. So I was like, this feels out of step. This is like so dark, so mean-spirited. Especially coming off of The Night Billy Raised Hell, which is, you know, kind of silly and funny, that I wasn't sure about this one the first time I saw it. Now, by the end, again, there's a turn that won me over. It's not just about these kids are evil. These are kids who are getting revenge on people who are even worse than them. And I like the way that Girash holds that reveal for a long time. This, are we in the oneer, right? Yeah, okay, so this shot, look at this. This is incredible. We follow her. We go over the fucking wall. I mean, across the pool, over the wall, and to the car. I love that shot. I love the lighting in this one as well. To me, this looks the most like a Dario Argento film. It has a very different, again, a very different vibe from the rest of the shorts. It is darker, but I think that's okay. And it brings up something. Here's Tiffany Shepis getting stabbed a bunch of times by children. It brings up something that persists throughout the film. And I brought it up to a couple of the directors in the course of doing my interviews and got different responses. Most of the filmmakers were like, oh yeah, I don't think I even realized that. And that may be because they're kind of focused on their short, and it's not until you step back that you realize how prevalent it is throughout the film. But it's kind of this fear of children that runs through the film. There are a number of segments. Sweet Tooth has it a little bit because the parents at the end of that film think that the kid has slaughtered the two teenagers. The Night Billy Raised Hell has it because you have a kid wreaking havoc on an entire neighborhood. Trick has it because you have kids who are committing heinous murders. And again, it's not till the end that you find out that they're doing it for the purposes of revenge, but it does make kids seem like evil little murderers. More segments will have it. Ryan Schifrin's kind of speaks to fear of children. Lucky McKee's is very much about fear of having children, not so much fear of actual physical children coming to kill you, but the fear of parenthood. And I don't know if that had to do with having just had kids. You know, I think Darren Bousman said that he had recently become a parent when this came together. Ryan Schifrin maybe had recently become a parent when this came together. I may be remembering this wrong, so I apologize. Again, this is just a fan commentary, and I don't think any of the filmmakers will ever hear it. But if you guys do, I'm sorry if I'm misspeaking. Honestly, I'm not trying to misrepresent you or your movie. I love it. That's why I'm talking about it. I love that. Look at the lighting on this. I mean, this is straight out of Inferno, you know. So I don't know if it's an unconscious thing, you know, the way that, like, to me, the thing that makes VHS so interesting, like, I don't love VHS, the first one, but it's interesting in the way that all of these segments, everybody went off and made their stuff. So now we're starting to find out that these adults have done horrible things to children. They've tortured them and mutilated them and eaten them and killed them. And that's why these kids are coming back to get revenge. You know, everybody went off in different directions for VHS, and what came together is like a very weird, it got branded misogynist a lot when it was released. And I can't argue with that, although I would make a case that it's about these filmmakers kind of confronting their own fears of women, that it's not about like, oh, women are scary and horrible. I think it's more like men are awful because they fear women. I don't know. I haven't worked that all out. But anyway, in the same way that all these shorts kind of come together and there's this kind of recurring theme of children being scary, right? Now, is it something that's actually being worked out through the art by a number of these filmmakers, or is it just built into the fucking holiday? Like, Halloween is more or less for kids. Yes, as an adult horror fan, I still love Halloween. Everyone associated with this movie still loves Halloween. That's why they chose to celebrate it as part of this movie. But it is more or less for kids, right? And so, of course, your stories are going to involve children. Anytime you are dealing with trick-or-treating, you are going to involve children. So this is just like some nasty shit here. And some of the images kind of recall like the opening of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I will never take issue with because that's my boy, Toby Hooper, representing. So there's a drawing there that looks very much, it's a pumpkin drawing because now we're into Paul Sollett's piece. That looks very much like the pumpkin that comes up again at the end in Neil Marshall's piece. So the more times you see this film, I think the better it becomes. This is The Week in the Wicked. This, again, is Paul Sollett's piece. Paul Sollett, the writer and director of Grace, which is an incredible movie if you've never seen it. He also made a movie called Dark Summer. And several of the cast members from Dark Summer show up in his segment here. There's Noah Segan, who's been in a bunch of indie horror films, Dead Girl and Starry Eyes and The Mind's Eye, and there's Boo Boo Stewart. The weekend that I saw this, there were a bunch of other movies that played, of course, and several of those films, these actors kept showing up. There's Grace Phipps. She had been in Dark Summer with Paul Sollett, but then she shows up later in The Weeknd in Some Kind of Hate, and Boo Boo Stewart shows up later in The Weeknd in He Never Died with Henry Rollins. So it was kind of cool to see these faces popping up again and again, and again creates this sense of continuity amongst the current horror scene. And some people may not like that. Some people may feel like, oh, I keep seeing the same people. I happen to love that. I love this idea that there's this group of people who are showing up in each other's movies and who continue to work together. And Tales of Halloween for me is a celebration of that as an idea. Again, I keep raving about this movie. I gave it 5 out of 5 stars on Daily Dead and continue to take shit about that from one of my friends, who I will not name. But again, the world is a rainbow, right? We all respond to different things. I wondered if maybe this was just opening night excitement for me. Maybe it was like, I'm at the premiere, it's not the official premiere, but certainly, you know, the Midwest premiere. I don't think it had played a lot by the time I saw it. I know it had played overseas because I think it played at Fright Fest. So there's certainly some of that excitement. I'm with a big audience. We're all responding to things. We're all excited, right? So was it a case of kind of losing myself in the moment? So the day it showed up on iTunes, I purchased it immediately, watched it again, still loved it, watched it again a week or two later as part of a scary movie night. We had friends over and we watched movies together, watched it again, still loved it. So my affection for this movie has not dissipated with repeat viewings. In fact, I only come to love it more because I keep noticing different little Easter eggs. Here's Keir Gilchrist from It Follows and also the star of Dark Summer with Paul Sollett. So this is a reunion of Grace Phipps and Keir Gilchrist right here. Paul Sollett's piece feels, again, very different from the three that precede it. He wanted to make a spaghetti western. So this is part like Sergio Leone, part Walter Hill. And it is very different. And I think for some people that I've talked to, they had a hard time with those tonal shifts. They had a hard time believing that like this is happening in the same town as the other segments. Because the implication in the movie is that it is one town on Halloween night, and that this is, you know, these events are all happening on different corners. You know, the street gang is a little bit stylized. There's something a little post-apocalyptic about them. Look at that gorgeous shot right there. But honestly, I think it's really just the stylization, because if you were to take this segment and shoot it less like a Leone film, I think people wouldn't have as much of a problem. So it's not so much what happens as the way it's put together and the way it's photographed. I happen to love it, again, because every couple of minutes you're getting a new movie, a different flavor, a different kind of horror film, a different experience, right? I've seen so many anthologies that just feel the same five times or six times. Even VHS, even the ABCs of Death, and I know those movies have their fans. I don't outright dislike either of them, but particularly ABCs of Death just wears me down. 26 shorts that all end the same way. And they've done two of them now, so it's like 52? Oh my god. Shorts that are essentially the same. There's ones where you're like, oh, that was good, that was clever, and there's some that are like, I don't ever need to see that again. But there's very little about those movies that has me wanting to come back to them, whereas this movie, again, is a ride from beginning to end, and now we get the flashback. I love the bunny costume. I love how it stands in such stark contrast to the street gang. I love that we have this origin story for this character, again, in a very small amount of time. Paul Sollett is working with a number of kind of spaghetti Western tropes and archetypes and really condensing them down to just a few minutes. And it's a segment that you enjoy more the more of these kinds of movies you've seen. You know, it's a little bit less horror-based maybe as some of the other ones, but it still speaks to, in some ways, kind of what teenagers are doing on Halloween. You know, they're having a very different experience than what the kids are experiencing on Halloween. That's kind of why I like that they're isolated in another part of town. They're not really interacting with the kids or the adults. They're off. Halloween is something very different for teenagers. But also to this idea of conjuring a demon and kind of these pagan elements to Halloween. And none of the other segments really address that aspect of Halloween as being a pagan holiday. So again, I like it. I don't know. Like I said, I'm excited to hear the commentaries on the official Blu-ray, because I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff I'm going to learn about the film. I feel bad for anybody who's listening to this for educational purposes, because I'm mostly just providing an appreciation, but that's really all a fan commentary can be, right? Again, I got great suggestions on movies to talk about for a commentary. Some of them were like 2.5 hour movies. Nobody wants to hear me talk that long. Some are like way too daunting, where I wouldn't have time to do proper research. One was Turbo Kid, which was another movie I saw this weekend, by the way, also produced through Epic, and loved that movie, absolutely loved it. But I don't know what I would say about it on a commentary, except like, oh, I love this. Oh, Apple's so cute. This music's so great. Look at this gore gag. There's Jason Eisner, you know, and I'm out. Whereas this one, at least, not only do I have some background knowledge about the movie because I had talked to the filmmakers, but also it shifts gears every couple of minutes. And so I have something new to talk about, you know, a different performance, a different actor, a different cameo, a different type of horror to gush over. I was positive. I like this monster a lot, too, by the way. And this monster became very... This was like the promotional image for the movie. This and Sweet Tooth were that shot right there, and Sweet Tooth were like the two shots. I was positive the first time I saw the movie that Keir Gilchrist did not blink when he got sprayed with the blood. in seeing it again, he does, but I don't care. I love that shot. And I do like that he immediately opens his eyes despite being covered in blood, because my reaction would just be to keep him closed until the blood is wiped away, but not Keir Gilchrist. So now we are into Axel Carolyn's short, Grim Grinning Ghost, a who's who of horror. We already saw Lynn Shay. We saw Lisa Marie. We saw Stuart Gordon. And then sitting there on the couch is Barbara Cramp. There's Lisa Marie and Stuart Gordon. Sitting on the couch next to Alex Esso there is Barbara Crampton, the great Barbara Crampton, and Mick Garris. So again, these are all people that I love. I have so much goodwill and affection for as a horror fan, as a film lover. And so to see a scene being played out by Stuart Gordon and Mick Garris and Barbara Crampton and Lynn Shay and Alex Esso, one of my new favorite actors in the horror genre, how can I not just completely love this film? I don't know. Alex Esso, of course, the star of Starry Eyes, which I should mention is a film that I saw the first time at the first Bruce Campbell Horror Fest. So each year, this fest introduces me to at least one movie that I flip out for. I'm hoping to see at least one more this year that I absolutely love. Hopefully more than one. That would be great. Because last year, again, I saw Tales of Halloween and Turbo Kid and Sunchoke, which I liked a lot, and Body, which I liked. So I'm excited for this year's. But Axel's, and I love the placement of Axel. So I was super excited to, again, see Alex Esso. Because I'm such a Starry Eyes fan, and her performance in that film, I think, is one for the ages. I think it's not only one of the best performances in a horror movie of many, many years, but just of any movie. I love this moment, too, because it's so economical in the way that it creates sympathy for Alex Esso. Again, you don't have a ton of time to work with, right? You have to create a character who is sympathetic. And in just those few lines of dialogue where Lynn Shay says, well, thank you for coming. And she says, well, listen, I know how much this means to you. She has a mom. She cares about her mom. She's here doing this thing that maybe she's not that into because it's important to her mom. Look at how beautiful this shot is too. This I think is maybe kind of the prettiest of them. And I'm not saying that in like a sexist way because it's the one that's shot by a female filmmaker. I just think it's very kind of gothic and beautiful. And Axel seems influenced by different kinds of movies than a lot of the other filmmakers, at least with her contribution. So I love the way, because it's very hard, because this entire segment is dependent on us being concerned for Alex Esso, right? She's possibly being chased by a ghost, and we don't want the ghost to get her. And in order to do that, she has to become sympathetic. And the way that she becomes sympathetic in such a short amount of time is, you know, she's being scared at this Halloween party that she's maybe not into, that she's attending because she loves her mom. And so all of a sudden, we're immediately invested in her well-being. It gives her humanity. It gives this stakes. She's someone's daughter. Her reaction to the car, the oh shit, is pretty great, including, all right, anyway, yeah, there it is. I knew there was another oh shit. Her phone doesn't work, so there's all these things working against her. What I love about Axel's piece is that it is, again, very different from the other shorts. Hers is definitely going more for atmosphere. It's the one that's really kind of trying to be scary. Some of them go comedic. Some of them go shocking. Some go silly. Some go gory. Sweet Tooth certainly has at least one terrific jump scare and is gorier. This one is really going for kind of a more of a slow burn build up to a scare. There's a good jump scare there, though. More of a slow burn build up to a scare, which is hard to do, again, in a very short amount of time. And so what Axel does with this, I think, is really terrific. It reminds me of her first feature in a good way. She, look at that. I mean, it's not just because Alex Esso is in the frame, but like, look at how gorgeous this shot is and look at that composition. It's really, really beautiful. So anyway, Axel Carolyn's first movie is called Soulmate, and it's a ghost story, but certainly more in kind of the gothic tradition. It's not trying to be super scary. Like, this one, I think, goes for scares more than Soulmate even, but the two have a similar energy to me. Look at that. Oh, man. Love that shot. Love it, love it, love it. So again, I've gotten in arguments about this one. That's maybe the scariest thing in the movie to me, is that shot right there. I've gotten in arguments about this one because I have friends who say, like, well, it's this buildup. There's a ghost, there's a ghost, it's a ghost. And then the punchline is, like, love that shot. Look at that. Oh, the shadows of the two hands are so, it's so great. There's a ghost, there's a ghost, there's a ghost. And then the punchline is, there's a ghost, and cut to black. And I don't know. I don't know what people want from an anthology, you know. We all want different things, I guess. I like the end. I like that it ends on a jump scare and then cuts to black. Because, again, this one is trying to unsettle you, to scare you. And so I think to, in some ways, release that tension by providing us that jump scare. But then in other ways, just actually making the tension worse, because we go from jump scare, hard cut to black, into the next one. So we're rattled when the next one starts. I think is even more unsettling in some ways, you know. So we're going to get an appearance. Earlier I had mentioned, like, there's all these weird connections to my own life, which I know sounds super dumb, but this dog looks exactly like my mother-in-law's dog. Exactly. And my mother-in-law's dog is named Baby. So we have Carnival of Souls on TV, which, again, is there because it's mostly public domain, I think, but also is not an accident based on the atmosphere that Axel is setting up here. It's much more appropriate than Night of the Living Dead. Anyway, my mother-in-law's dog is actually named Baby. So when I saw that dog, I was like, that looks like Baby. And then she calls it Baby. It's just one of these weird connections that I was able to make to my own life. But the dog is actually played by Anubis, which is Axel's real life dog. And here we get the jump scare and cut to black. I think it's great. I love it. Again, I don't think there's a bad segment in the bunch. And now we come up on this fucked up image. And it's a totally different vibe immediately. The dissolve and the superimposition of the flame and the face. We are now, you know, in the hands of a very different filmmaker. That is so exciting to me, you know. That's one of the aspects about the movie that I love so much. So this is Lucky McKee's short, and I should disclose, I guess, it's called Ding Dong. I should disclose that I am a huge fan of Lucky McKee. I love all these filmmakers that are present in this film. Lucky is one of the ones that whose work excites me most in terms of his feature work. I think May and The Woman are two of the best horror films of the 2000s, without question. I recently kind of rediscovered The Woods, which I had unfairly dismissed a little bit the first time I saw it because it was so different from May. And I don't know what I was thinking, because recently I rewatched it because it came out on Blu-ray. And I was like, actually, there's a lot of similarities to May. And also, look at this design. This is incredible. And also, it's just a great, beautifully made film. I love the simplicity of this effect. I mean, and again, in talking with Lucky, he said there's something that's like unsettling, kind of fucked up about just a really bold primary color, but also just the length of Pollyanna McIntosh's fingers, her super expressive face, and that giant mouth she has, her candy cane arms. It was a design that was come up with by, and this is very funny to me, Mark Center's kind of page boy wig,
cracks me up. Lucky McKee's wife came up with kind of the design of the witch, the creature, whatever it is that you want to call it. So this is one that's, you know, in some ways on its surface, just kind of a riff on Hansel and Gretel with Pollyanna McIntosh playing the witch and Mark Center almost standing in for Hansel. Here's again the kids from Adam Girosh's segment who are at the door here, so we know that this is all happening in town. So in some ways, it's just kind of a riff on Hansel and Gretel, obviously, but then it's sort of the most metaphorical of the bunch, which I know sounds pretentious and douchey, but it is so much about the male fear of having kids, of not being able to have kids, of disappointing your wife, of not being sure that you are fit to be a parent, that your wife is fit to be a parent. You know, that's all the stuff that's going on in Mark Center's mind right now. And Pollyanna McIntosh is such an incredible actress, and she's worked with Lucky McKee before in The Woman. Think about the range that she goes through here. She's very broad and funny. There's the boy from Sweet Tooth, Trick or Treating. She's sexy, and not just because she's pushing up her boobs, but because she's Pollyanna McIntosh, and she's just unbelievably hot. He shows up later in The Ransom of Rusty Rex there, Ryan Schifrin's segment. And then she's heartbreakingly sad. So this is all, you know, kind of silly and funny, but when she does weep over not being able to have a baby, it is a very real response. And we know, okay, she's this witch and shouldn't have a baby because she's abusive and, you know, sort of monstrous, but I don't know, just having been through things like this, knowing people who have been through, you know, wanting a kid and not being able to have one, it's legitimately heartbreaking. You know, she becomes abusive, but when she is sad, I love this effect, just the hand behind her. Again, so simple, not done with CGI, not an expensive prosthetic, not an expensive makeup, just simplicity, but imaginative and twisted in just the right way. Lucky McKee is the only filmmaker who was not based out of Los Angeles. He was really the only one who flew in to do his short. I believe he shot his short last. And again, just because they wanted to include him as fans and as friends. So he was the only one not based in Los Angeles and came in to do this short. And again, I love it. I think there are some audiences who want certain things from horror who would not respond to this because it is working on such a subtextual level. And again, I know I sound like such a douchebag. There are plenty of horror fans whose favorite will be this segment for that reason, you know, because it is, you can hook into it so emotionally, I think, more than any of the others. This is not a short about visceral reactions. It's much more about emotional reactions, even though there are visceral reactions. That witch is terrifying, you know, the long fingers and the arm coming out from behind her. Those are disturbing images that are incredibly effective. But it is more about emotionally unsettling its audience rather than making them jump or say boo or making them laugh or any of those things, even though it is funny in a lot of ways, you know? And that's one of the reasons why I love Lucky McKee's work so much, is his ability to juggle tones. And they're not gear shifts. It's not, okay, it's funny, and then it's this, and then it's this. It's like, it's all of those things at once. And that's incredible to me. I mean, that's why I think people had such a hard time processing The Woman, because they're like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about this. because the movie, for all of its lack of subtlety, isn't saying, here's how you should feel. He's not necessarily directing you to feel any specific way. It's all those things going on at once. And that's something that I love in horror films. It's one of the reasons why I love, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which a lot of people just don't dig. But for me, it's like that movie is horrifying and comedic and gory and silly and satirical all at the same time. It's not like, okay, now we're this, and then we switch to this, and then this. It's like all that stuff is exploding out of the screen simultaneously, and you got to let it all hit you and try to process it. Again, the extremity of the black makeup under her eyes, there's nothing realistic about it, but it's so effective. And then the other arm coming out here, this is such a wonderful image. I'm just such a huge fan of Pollyanna McIntosh. And Mark Center was somebody that Lucky McKee had wanted to work with for a long time. He was a producer on The Lost, which was directed by Chris Sievertson, who had worked with Lucky McKee a number of times. They had directed All Cheerleaders Die together twice. Once just as kind of a thing that they did on their own and was never really widely released, I don't think. And then again, just a year or two ago, they remade their own film. But Lucky McKee was a producer on that, and Mark Center played the lead. It's based on the Jack Ketchum novel. Lucky McKee and Jack Ketchum have worked together a number of times writing books. They have another one coming out in November that I'm super excited for. But if you haven't read I'm Not Sam, you absolutely should. So now we are into, and I screw up this title all the time, This Means War. I always want to call it I Declare War, which is the name of that movie that came out a couple of years ago about the kids playing guns in the forest, and it's awesome. So This Means War is written and directed by John Skip and Andrew Cash. It's the only short that is directed by more than one filmmaker, a team. And it is, I would argue, the most overtly comic short in the bunch. But it is a short that has something real on its mind. And that is this divide that exists between kind of classic horror, the people who are on the classic horror film boards, the lovers of old Universal monster movies, and kind of the new gorehounds who are into kind of more the Rob Zombie aesthetic. And it's kind of about this conflict between these two. And again, both filmmakers said, you know, they didn't really want to take a side because they love both. You can have both. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And I completely agree with that. As a fan of both sides of the street, as it were, I don't ever feel the need to choose because I can watch Lords of Salem and then I can watch Bride of Frankenstein and I'll have a great time with both. That boy again shows up in Neil Marshall's short. And Dana Gould, of course, is playing the classic horror fan, which is fitting because Dana Gould is a classic horror fan, a huge monster kid. And then across the street, you have James Duvall from Donnie Darko and Independence Day and The Doom Generation and Lucky McKee's May, as kind of the Fangoria generation, you know, more metal dude. I was positive, by the way, that I knew the girl next to James Duvall and even looked up IMDb to make sure that it wasn't who I thought it was, but she looks very much like somebody that I know. bunch of cameos in this one. Sean Clark is in the group somewhere, and Sean Clark, of course, is agent to the stars. He has very discernible hair. He represents a bunch of horror clients on the convention circuit, and hosts Horror's Hallowed Grounds on a bunch of the Scream Factory Blu-rays, where he goes to locations from famous horror movies and talks about them. So he shows up as part of that group. And again, anytime you have a big crowd scene, and this is one of the last big crowd scenes in the movie, you have a lot of recognizable faces. I think this is the sequence that has all three members of Killer POV, now Shockwaves, somewhere in the street. Rebecca McKendry, Rob Galuzzo, and Elric Kane are all out there somewhere. Hi, guys. Their original idea that they pitched, I think, was going to be about one of those haunted houses that, like, if you've ever seen the documentary Hell House, which you should absolutely see if you haven't, there are these haunted houses, many of which exist in, like, Texas and kind of down south, that are about real sins. They're very kind of religious, and it's like, here's what happens if you have an abortion, you die and go to hell. Here's what happens if you have premarital sex or whatever. And so it's not like monsters jumping out, it's just the horror of sin or something. And so they were going to set their short in one of those and then have it being actually operated by the devil. And that got kind of nixed because it does have such a political bent to it, which I understand. I mean, and I really like this, the idea that they came up with here, because while it is just fun and addresses a different aspect of Halloween, which is this idea of, you know, decorating your house, of making haunted houses or whatever. This is really, yeah, so many cameos here as the camera goes by. This is the short, you know, each short kind of addresses a different aspect of Halloween, and this is very much about Halloween decorations, but does address that schism that exists in the horror community. And I'm coming off of, I'm sure there were 10 people I should have named right there. I'm coming off of Flashback Weekend here in Chicago just a couple weeks ago, and the schism is not... it's not as bad as I think sometimes, you know. I get a little bit discouraged. But most of the people I see there, whether they're representing classic horror or kind of more, there's Felissa Rose again, there's Rebecca McKendry and Marnie again, or more contemporary horror, it seems like everyone just loves horror and is there to get along. And that's really what John Skip and Andrew Cash wanted to celebrate with their short, this idea of, can't we all just get along? Because it's horror. And there's Mike Mendez and Axel again, and there's Spooky Dan Walker. We all love horror, and we're here to celebrate that. So let's not fight, you know? Let's not accidentally murder each other in the street, which is what happens right there. Oops. Again, a nice little encapsulation, a nice little punchline. Here we have Graham Skipper and Adam Green returning again. And getting ready to throw up. Yep, there we go. Green pukes. Because that's what he does, man. If you've seen the Hatchet movies, he's just in the street puking. Do I wish that... I'm happy to have Graham Skipper in the movie. Do I wish that the other cop had been played by Joe Lynch? Sure, yes, of course. Because I would love to see Joe Lynch represented in the movie. But it's fun to see them, again, popping up throughout the film. And now we are into the next segment already. So these things just completely fly by. And this is Friday the 31st, which I will say the night I saw... This is Mike Mendez's segment. And Mike Mendez is a producer on the film and was one of the filmmakers in attendance the night of the screening that I saw. And I will say that the night... that I saw this, I came away positive that this was my favorite. There's Axel's. I think that's Axel's head. I know her head shows up later, so that's not her head. I was positive that this was my favorite. Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely not Axel. Sorry, Axel. I was positive that this was my favorite segment in the bunch because it played unbelievably well and is just... so inventive and so funny, and I still love it. I'm not throwing any shade at it, but the more times I watch the film, the more I'm like, I think I got to go with Sweet Tooth. But I really love this one, and this is, I think, earlier I might have said that Sweet Tooth is the goriest. This one is definitely the goriest, but in a way that is very funny. So here's a bunch of the filmmakers. That was Neil Marshall right there. A bunch of the filmmakers. Play the corpses here. There's Axel's head in the pumpkin. And right next to it is a head that looks exactly like Jason's mom that's in the in Friday the 13th Part 2, the shriveled up head, you know, is laying right next to Axel's head. So there's another little Easter egg. Whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know for sure. I've never heard Mike Mendez confirm that, and yet I have a hard time believing that it was accidental. I love this design. Again, you have filmmakers who have so little time to work with, and yet you have, you know, Dave Parker establishes the legend of Sweet Tooth in a very short amount of time. Axel establishes a ghost story, the story of the grim grinning ghost, in a very short amount of time. Mike Mendez, in a very short amount of time, creates, I'm positive that's Victor Crowley's head on the thing there, but again, I've never had that confirmed. Creates, I won't say an iconic slasher, because it does resemble, you know, Jason Voorhees so similarly, and yet the mask is tweaked enough to still work and be really effective. This wooden mask, it looks like a hockey mask, but it has just the one hole cut out. If you put that in a slasher movie tomorrow, you would absolutely buy it. And this is, you know, the slasher movie of the bunch. You can't have a celebration of horror films without in some way representing slasher movies. And what I love about this is that it sets up, okay, here's this slasher. He's been at it for a while. He has a shed full of bodies, and we think that that's what we're going to see. And then it becomes this crazy thing with this little alien done in claymation who only says trick or treat. And I defy you not to laugh every single time he says trick or treat, because it's just the cutest thing. This, the slasher's reaction to it is so goddamn funny. And then it morphs again into an Evil Dead style kind of possession thing that just becomes total, you know, slapstick gore. And I love all that shit. I love the energy of this one. This, I think, was born out of, in talking to Mike Mendez again for these interviews that I did for Daily Dead, all of which you can read at dailydead.com, was born out of, I believe this was the original opening to a movie that he wanted to do and could never get it okayed, either because it's too weird or too gory. But when he found out, okay, you kind of have carte blanche to do whatever you want as part of your segment in Tales of Halloween, he was like, well, no fucking way I'm going to miss the chance to do this. And so he made it his segment. And again, I just love it. I love the way that this too is happening in a very remote part of town, and yet, because we have the girl who was dressed up for the Halloween party, we know that she came from the part of town that, you know, everybody was in and got chased here by this killer. Here we have this great kind of Evil Dead effect. The makeup looks very much like Evil Dead. The glowing green eyes are fun. The thing that I love is the way that she moves. And the tables are immediately turned, and it just becomes comic. And then we get into the crazy gore, which is just so funny. Again, the fact that the killer can't talk and is just doing a series of noises, I love that there, makes it so much funnier. The fact that she still has the spear through her is very funny to me. I know I'm just gushing over this, everyone, and I'm sorry. I don't see a point in doing a commentary for a movie, especially when I'm by myself. I have to fill this amount of time alone. Yeah, it's going to be for a movie that I really love, because, I mean, that is so fucking funny. And another thing that I love, and maybe this is just a budgetary thing, is that almost all of the effects are achieved practically. You know, again, the little alien dude is a claymation thing, which makes it so much greater, by the way. But the effects, you know, the gore effects in this and in Sweet Tooth are all practical effects. They're not just leaning on CGI, which maybe that's a budgetary thing. Maybe CGI would take too long or be too expensive. I don't know, but I love the effects in this movie. I love how it celebrates gore, because as now we have two bodies standing across from each other, both spurting blood from their neck wounds. As basic and as ridiculous as it sounds, that is one of the things that can be fun about horror movies, you know? And there are plenty of people who, I don't like horror movies because I don't like gore. But if you're a horror fan, the two kind of go hand in hand. And so to see shorts like this that celebrate that aspect of horror is another reason why, to me, this anthology is so satisfying, because it pushes so many different buttons. Because it celebrates so many different aspects of the genre, which is, you know, again, for my taste, the most varied of all genres. There's so much you can do inside of horror, and this movie really does a nice job of representing that, of how just malleable the genre is, and all the different kind of facets that you can, all the different sandboxes that you can kind of play in, you know, and everybody in this movie, to me, is playing in a different sandbox. Here's the fucking great John Landis making a cameo, saying goodbye to his son. And again, so now we're into Ryan Schifrin's segment, The Ransom of Rusty Rex, which is really fun. And again, Ryan Schifrin wanted to explore not a different aspect of Halloween. This one is certainly about trick-or-treating in some ways, but also just he kind of hooked into this idea of, well, what are these two criminals doing on Halloween? He kind of went to this place of like, I want to follow different kinds of characters, because we have all these people who are doing trick-or-treaters, or, you know, people at home answering the door for trick-or-treaters. On both sides of it too, which I love, because we get, you know, Darren Bousman's segment is all about the kid knocking at the door. And then we go into Lucky McKee's segment, and it's all about the people that are inside the house answering the door. So the movie kind of comes at it from both sides. So this is, you know, there's trick-or-treating certainly plays a part in this, but really this is more kind of about, well, what are these two criminals doing on Halloween? And is another short that kind of speaks to this fear of children, because what we discover is we kidnap who we think is a child. He's not a child. He's some sort of weird demon thing who exists to make our life hell, who we have to keep feeding, who we can't get rid of. You know, this person never goes away. And that's as dark as it sounds. I have two kids and I love them. There is that feeling of like, oh, right, I'm responsible for you for the rest of my life. Like, that never goes away. And this kind of taps into that fear a little bit. This idea of like, try as I might, I can't escape the fact that I'm responsible for you now. There's another subtext of this segment that I don't think was deliberate. I'd asked Ryan Schifrin about, like, you know, well, how did John Landis come about? And he just said, you know, he wanted somebody who is sort of iconic, which Landis certainly is. He wanted somebody who was formidable. Landis certainly is. It happened to be, I think, at a Masters of Horror dinner. And Landis was there and talked to him about it. And he signed on, right? So that may be the whole story. A friend of mine, again, I won't say who, once pointed out to me, John Landis has a very famous son who rubs some people the wrong way. And I thought, well, that's a very interesting subtext, given who's playing the dad. Could this be a commentary on that? And I am not at all putting that intent on Ryan Schifrin. It's just a subtext that I am reading. I don't think that has anything to do with why he cast Landis. Because I didn't even put it together the first one or two times I saw the film. It wasn't until somebody else pointed it out to me that I was like, oh, that's very interesting, knowing the reputation for Landis's real-life son. Give me a sec. I got to take something to drink. I'm losing my voice, everyone. So that's, I'm going to get his name wrong. Sam Claflin? Do I have that right? Sam Witwer. From The Mist. He's the soldier who gets kind of sacrificed in The Mist. Again, very kind of extreme lighting. And a lot of the segments use, you know, kind of that very bold primary color lighting. And I don't know for sure if that was a function of each filmmaker saying, that's what I want, you know, that's how I want it to look. Was it a function of the filmmakers all sitting down? Because they did, you know, this movie came together collectively, not just as a bunch of individuals separately, but it came together. It came together as a group. I love his reaction there too. The way that extra shot is what sells me on that moment. It came together as a group. So it's very possible that they sat together and said, we want these to look similar. So what are some things that we can do that will create some continuity across the segments? You know, it was all done as part of a single shoot with the same crew. So you're talking about, you know, same production designers, possibly same DPs. I honestly haven't really looked at the credits to know, was it one DP or did everyone bring their own DP? And so that could also explain why there are similarities in terms of the way that each of the segments looks, and yet the color palettes are different. They don't all look the same. Darren Bousman's has a lot of that blue light. When we get into Adam Girosh's, it's kind of pink and red. This one obviously is using a lot of green. So I don't ever feel like the segments start to feel the same, even in their visual approach, much less in the, you know, the stories that are being told, the tone of the stories. And I know, listen, anthologies are just that way. You have people that swear that Creepshow 2 is better than Creepshow 1. I'll never understand those people. Yeah, The Raft is pretty good. And I've even come around on Thanks for the Ride, Lady. But you're never going to get past Chief Woodenhead. And Creepshow is, you know, arguably the greatest anthology ever, right? Horror anthology, specifically. Trick or Treat belongs in that conversation. Black Sabbath belongs in that conversation. I'm a big fan of Tales of Terror. I wouldn't argue that it's one of the best ones ever, but in terms of like that Corman Poe cycle, I really like that one, especially because of that middle segment with Peter Lorre and Vincent Price in the wine tasting contest. Once you get beyond, you know, the heavy hitters, I think everything else is real subjective. Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, has a lot to like in it, right? The original Tales from the Crypt has things to like in it, or the Vault of Horror, those kind of Amicus anthologies. From a Whisper to a Scream has some cool stuff in it. Tales from the Hood has cool stuff in it, but you're not going to find any of those that are completely consistent. There's going to be, oh, I like this segment and maybe that one, but then the other three are okay to bad, you know? So I recognize it's all subjective, and there's... So when people tell me, like, oh, I don't like Tales of Halloween as much as you, or I don't like each segment, I like maybe a few segments or whatever, I get it. I don't necessarily argue that they should. Now, there's an effect that's done CG, but done very well. I'm not saying, like, you have to love this, but I also don't want to be told that I'm wrong for loving it, because if anything, I hope this commentary expresses not just that I do love it, but a lot of the why. That's kind of why I do these things, is to get a chance to talk about all the things that I like in a movie. That's one of the reasons why I thought about doing Halloween 4 as a commentary, but there's a lot of commentaries for Halloween 4. There are several on the Scream Factory disc. The Movie Crypt did its own commentary with Danielle Harris. You're not going to get any new information about the movie from listening to me talk about it. You'll just get me celebrating Dwight H. Little. Not that you're getting a ton of new information. I love his reaction to Landis here. You're not getting a ton of new information about Tales of Halloween from listening to me talk about it either. And you're probably annoyed, actually, because you're like, wait a second, it's August. Why wouldn't you save this commentary for October? I want it out there so that you have it when the movie comes out on Blu-ray in a few weeks. And hopefully you are buying it on Blu-ray, because if you're not, at the very least, it's like $8 on iTunes, I think. And even the iTunes version does come with some extra features. That is a steal, because I will definitely watch. You know, I bought it on iTunes. I'm buying the Blu-ray. This is a movie that I'm going to break out every October for sure, and have watched outside of October several times already. It's only been out a year. I've probably seen it 5 or 6 times already. We get it. You're a fan. Fuck you. I like it. Carl's Jr. Fuck you. I'm eating. And so now we kind of get the punchline. And by the way, this has one of my absolute favorite moments in the entire movie, which is he still bites the burger. I fucking think that's so funny. He does the wide mouth freak out and then still takes a bite of his burger, which I think is so perfect. And now we're at the end, and you can't escape Rusty Rex. And now we're up to the final segment, which is Neil Marshall's segment, Bad Seed, which is another great one. Right away, you can kind of tell just the way that there's Serena Vincent. That is the best carved pumpkin I've ever seen. Those cuts, I think, right away tell you that you're watching a Neil Marshall one. Because honestly, the first time I saw the film, I knew who had worked on it, but I didn't know whose segment was whose. I'd seen the opening credits, but by the time the movie opens, you're not sure whose segment is whose. And, you know, you can't remember the order that you saw it in or whatever. So sometimes you're just looking for clues here and there. You know, Pollyanna McIntosh shows up and you're like, well, okay, I know this is Lucky McKee's, you know. Other times it's kind of about stylistic things and the way that this one, I think by the time this one came around, I probably figured out, I love that gore gag, by the way. By the time this one came around, I probably had figured out that this was Neil Marshall. I love that he did this practically again, instead of using CGI, which may have just been out of necessity. But again, you're talking about a group of filmmakers who I'm guessing don't love how much CGI has invaded horror. Here's Christina Kleeb making her entrance as the hard-boiled Detective McNally interacting with Adam Green and Graham Skipper again. And this is another fun short because it does feel big. It's kind of the biggest in scope and also, again, gets to incorporate so many different cast members from the film and some of the other filmmakers and all that shit. By this point I probably knew like, oh, I think only Neil Marshall is left, but I also knew just stylistically right away, oh, this is Neil Marshall's. It just has a different rhythm to the cutting. I mean, how great is that gag trying to stuff the head and getting stuck to the hand? Oh, listen, everyone, I love the movie. Okay. If there was time, I would be badgering the company to put this commentary on. Hopefully none of the filmmakers would object because they'd be like, oh, this guy just sucks our dicks for 100 minutes. Metaphorically speaking, of course. The sketch artist, and this is one of my favorite gags in the movie, that the pumpkin is so badly drawn, but also is played by the great Drew Struzan, who has done poster art. Every poster you've ever seen that you love is drawn by Drew Struzan. There's an entire documentary made about Drew Struzan. He did a poster for the film. Here's the little boy you saw from earlier in the film. He did a poster for the film, and I just love that he plays the sketch artist, and then that his sketch is so rudimentary and kind of childish. It's a little bit better than I can do, because let's face it, he's still fucking Drew Struzan, but not much better. So again, the way that this morphs from kind of a monster movie, a killer pumpkin one, again, this is the one. It probably goes without saying that this is the one that deals with pumpkins, everyone. But again, it's just covering a different aspect of Halloween, right? That you only get that when everyone sits down before they start and says, like, let's not have these overlap, you know? Let's if you're already addressing one facet of Halloween in your short, I don't want to do it in mine. So they really spread them out. Here's the one that's very pumpkin-centric. It starts as kind of this monster movie. It morphs into a buddy cop movie before turning into Halloween 3 Season of the Witch at the end. Willingness to Kill a Child. Something that has kind of, I won't say gone out of fashion. Some of the kids from Adam Girosh's segment are up on that wall. Again, just little Easter eggs. Here and there, there's Axel being led away. There's Paul Sollett. A bunch of the filmmakers from other segments show up in this police station. If I was able to pause them, I could tell you, like, oh, that's Dave Parker. But I don't know where he shows up because I haven't been able to. John Savage playing the captain. Again, a great bit of casting for this kind of, you know, we're doing this kind of old school. We're doing this old school cop movie. And so, yeah, bringing John Savage in to play the captain is super inspired. So we have references now as he talks about the other things that are going on in the town. Kids looting convenience stores, a UFO. You know, it makes sense that this one goes last, obviously, because it ties a lot of the rest of the movie together. This is the one that says, hey, it's all going on in the same town. So we have the UFO reference from Mike Mendez's. We get Darren Bousman's reference from the kids looting the convenience stores. So again, the scope of this one is so wide that it's able to incorporate all of the other shorts. Now they're referencing Sweet Tooth. Some kid ate a bunch of chocolate and then he ate the babysitter, licking the chocolate off of themselves. So we reference all the way back to the beginning, Sweet Tooth. Here's Pat Healy, who shows up, much to my delight. Pat Healy, a great actor and star of several genre films in recent years, who gets the setup here, you know, buy me a drink. Here's Paul Sollett's little joke. That setup there, buy me a drink later, then when it pays off in just a few minutes, again, because none of these segments are very long, was, I don't want to say it was my biggest laugh of the film the first time I saw it, but boy, it was up there. I feel terrible because I'm like running out of steam a little bit, but that's because I've talked nonstop for an hour and 27 minutes at this point, everyone. I have to breathe. My hope is, now we get to just crazy fucking anarchy. And again, some familiar faces showing up on the street. The reveal of the pumpkin on the windshield of the car is terrific, and we're coming up on the payoff of that. I love the pumpkin effect. We're coming up on the payoff, which is terrific, of the Pat Healy thing. My dream, you know, is that the film would have made a bunch of money, and it got a small theatrical release. I think a lot of I'm hoping it made a lot of its money on rentals and VOD and stuff, and that people didn't pirate this movie like fucking assholes. But I mean, that's a fucking great reveal there too. My wish was that it would make enough money to do another Tales of Halloween and either let this exact same group of filmmakers tell another story, which I think would be super fun, or a brand new group of filmmakers, you know, and rotate people, in and out. It was one of the reasons I had so hoped that Grindhouse had made a bunch of money, was because every 2 years I wanted a new Grindhouse with new filmmakers, you know, kind of doing their spin on it. And so I really was hoping for more Tales of Halloween or whatever. That it may still happen. I don't know. Hopefully you guys all buy this on iTunes because you want to watch it with, okay, this Pat Healy throwing her the gun, showing up out of nowhere, throwing her the gun, The way that the pumpkin explodes in a gory and violent way, and then the payoff about, like, let's go get that drink. I just loved the way that this turned into such an 80s cop movie. Yeah, there we go. Guess I owe you that drink now. And his reaction. And then, of course, we get to this great cameo coming up. The mad scientist of the pumpkin factory. Clover Corp, of course, being a reference to Halloween 3, which nothing about this segment hides. You know, no one's trying to love his... I mean, that's right out of the 80s cop movie playbook right there, his reaction. This shot might as well be in Season of the Witch. And, of course, Joe Dante opens the door, and I jizz in my pants because I'm such a Joe Dante fan that just when I thought I couldn't love this movie more, we're minutes away from its conclusion, and they still have the ability to surprise me with a Joe Dante cameo. So that was very, very exciting for me. I love the movie. I love it, right? The one thing that I wish was a little bit different, and this is not a criticism of Neil Marshall's segment, but it ends on just kind of a fade to black, and then the credits come up. And that's... I don't miss, like, a wraparound segment, and I guess they did experiment a little bit with ideas for wraparounds. You know, most anthologies have that kind of a wraparound. They shot, I think, some more stuff with Adrienne Barbeau that she was gonna... I mean, that's a great, great, great reveal. I love it. But then it just kind of fades to black, and the movie's over. There's no real stinger at the end. They had shot some more stuff with Adrienne Barbeau, I guess, and tried to make it work, but it didn't quite. She gets a little bit of voiceover here, which is okay, but part of me does wish that the only reason I would want a wraparound was to have something to go back to after that fade to black. You know what I mean? It's a great ending for that. It's a great ending for the segment. It's not my favorite ending for the movie. But again, that is a super nitpick for a movie that I otherwise enjoy without reservation, you know, which I think I've demonstrated through the course of this commentary. Hopefully you guys all buy it on iTunes so that you can listen to my commentary that you don't care about. Certainly buy the Blu-ray when it comes out just for the extra features, which are going to be incredible. But I think that this is a movie that could easily, you know, be busted out every October. And enjoyed whether you watch it the same night as Trick or Treat, or, you know, you watch this one night, Trick or Treat the next night. I know Trick or Treat is beloved, and doing an anthology set on Halloween, to me, had to be a daunting proposition for these filmmakers. And they even said, you know, we love Trick or Treat. So that was certainly on our minds. I mean, it had to be a daunting proposition because you have an anthology that's pretty recent that does that really, really well. You know, it. And so to exist in the movie's shadow a little bit, for lack of a better word, had to be slightly daunting. But I think this movie does a great job of being an anthology that's on Halloween that is so independent of Trick or Treat, that has such a different vibe and such a different energy to it, so as to not... Brian J. Smith, by the way, editor of Darren Bousman's segment, boyfriend of, I guess I can say, of my friend Heather Wixon, who I mentioned earlier. It's fun to see his name in the credits. I think this movie does a great job of existing totally independently of Trick or Treat, that I think you could watch both in the same night and not feel like there's overlap except for the Halloween iconography, which, you know, if you're a horror fan or you're watching these in October, I wouldn't think you'd have any objection to Halloween iconography. It's the best. What else can I say? I mean, I'm sure if I went through these credits, there would be a lot of names that I recognize. I'm sure, you know, the people that live out in LA and are part of this community, I'm sure know almost every name in this, in these end credits. There are just certain names that I recognize, and I won't call out what they are. You know, Sean Spillane did the music for Lucky McHugh segment. He did the songs in The Woman, which I love and have on my iPod, which is still a thing that I use, by the way, but like a first generation one. A lot of people feel weird about the kind of pop songs that are on the soundtrack for The Woman. I love it. I love the way that they interact with the film. It looks like, if I'm reading this right, we have some different DPs that worked on the film. So that answers my question. Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that you're as big a fan of this movie as I am. And if not, maybe give it another chance, or at least respect all the things that I love about it. Buy it on iTunes if you haven't. Buy it when it comes out on DVD. Support independent horror. We are living through a fucking golden age right now in independent horror. Studio horror is having something of a resurgence, thanks to James Wan, thanks to Blumhouse. But man, independent horror is where it is at. And the filmmakers that took part in this movie, whether on camera or behind, are many of the filmmakers who are responsible for the most exciting stuff that is happening in the genre right now. And you need to support these filmmakers. Check out their other work if you're not familiar with it. They're doing just really exciting shit. And I can point you to at least one film from almost everyone here that you should see, with the exception of Andrew Cash and John Skip, and that's only because they have not yet directed a feature. Everyone else has at least one feature that you should absolutely see. I would run out of time before I got through all of them, but independent horror is in such an exciting place right now, thanks to the filmmakers who participated in this movie, and others, of course, but this film is such a celebration of horror right now, that it feels so current, and yet I think, you know, hopefully will be timeless. 20 years from now, we may not recognize who some of the people are that pop up on camera because they're not acting as much or because their careers aren't as hot. Who knows, right? Who could say? But I think no matter what, that the stories and the energy of the film is going to be timeless. So thank you guys very much for listening. Again, Patrick Brawley, fthismovie.net. I'm out. Happy Halloween a few months from now. Support independent horror. Always leave candy out for Sweet Tooth.